Hi, welcome to Award Wieners. This is a night at the Oscars where David and I, John, watch Oscar-winning movies while enjoying Oscar Mayer Wieners. It's a celebration of American culinary and cinematic pop culture. In our second Weenie Roast, we'll be discussing the 1935 Academy Award winner for Outstanding Production and sea shanty inspiring Mutiny on the Bounty. Hey, Dave. It was just Thanksgiving. I wanted to say happy Thanksgiving to everyone, including you, Dave. How was your
Thanks.
Thanksgiving?
My Thanksgiving was pretty good. I actually hosted this year and only one person got sick, so that basically makes me an Iron Chef.
Does it? So,
Yeah.
how sick did they get?
They didn't leave the house the next day, but I maintain it's not my fault.
Was it your girlfriend?
No, I did all the cooking.
No, no,
I
no, no, no. Did your girlfriend get sick, is what I'm saying.
Oh no. It was David F, who lives down the street from me.
Gotcha.
We think it's because we had two punch bowls and there was probably only lemons and sugar that wasn't alcohol in them. So could have been a hangover.
Gotcha. Well, that sucks for David.
Yeah. What did you do?
So this is kind of interesting. I went to Baltimore with my girlfriend, and her aunt and uncle live there. That's not the interesting part. The Smithsonian, so I volunteer at the Smithsonian, they cater meals for volunteers, so you can buy a meal. And we got it from the African American History and Culture Museum, and since they have a restaurant in that museum, and it was great. It was absolutely fantastic, the meal. So I think everyone was really happy with our decision. We didn't have to cook anything or prepare anything. We just had to pick the meal up and then heat it up. It was perfect.
So are you ready to get into the movie and talk about this?
Sure. Have you seen Mutiny on the Bounty before, Dave?
No, and I knew very little about it. I was telling a friend that we were going to watch this, and he got really excited because he apparently loves the book. How about you?
I actually had seen the movie before, but for some reason I remembered it being more of a musical, for and I don't know why, but that's what I thought. Maybe I had it confused with something else, but I have seen it before.
This would be a really weird musical, John. Like the torture scenes,
This
very,
the
very
sea
weird.
shanties and the whipping to the beat, it all makes sense, Dave.
So how would you describe this?
In one sentence, I would say the movie is basically a bunch of angry sailors who take out their cruel captain, so they can live a hedonistic island lifestyle with a bunch of native women.
I think that's pretty good. My one sentence would be a proto torture porn on the high seas and with a half-assed love story attached.
Have you ever been sailing, Dave? I think that's another good question here.
No, I've been on like pontoon boats and those what are they?
Paddle boats.
Swans in San Francisco, you paddle around in a lake, middle of a man-made lake, but I'm not much of a water person. How about you?
So I've been sailing once before, and I would say we could have had a mutiny on the Bounty. I was actually giving our captain a hard time because so we were sailing, first time sailing for me. It was actually a lot of fun. It's actually kind of cool to get the sails up and have the wind pull you along. We never really got going all that fast. But if you want to turn around, you have to adjust the sails so they catch the wind and basically push the boat in a certain way. Our captain thought we could make a turn, catch the wind and sort of make kind of a tight turn in this boat. And it was a big boat. It's a skipjack, so about 30 feet long. We did not get enough wind and didn't quite make the turn and ended up hitting a dock. And the captain said to me, he's like, "John, I need you to go below and see if we're taking on water." And I'm like, "Wow, this is really serious. I have to go below deck and check." I went below deck, actually no real damage done. The dock took the brunt of it. The front of the boat got pretty dinged up and had to be fixed, but we did not sink. The captain told me later that that was the first time. He's actually a commercial captain as well. I think he did some kind of giant boats that brought some kind of cargo in and out of places for most of his life, and that was the first time he'd ever had to send anyone below to check if he had destroyed a ship.
That's a really good story.
Yeah.
So you could basically, you're a sailor now. You can do anything.
Well, Dave, I'm a cabin boy, is what I would say.
Have you seen Cabin Boy?
Not in a long time, but I have.
I absolutely love that movie. There are some weird parts into it. The whole thing's weird, but the flying talking cupcake that spits tobacco is amazing.
I apparently don't remember this movie at all, Dave. I don't remember that scene. maybe that'll be a movie we review in the near future.
A holiday Christmas special.
Yeah.
Just like just non-Oscar, just the worst movie we could find. All right, John, let's do the carpet.
So if you're a first-time listener, you should know that we eat movie-themed hot dogs while watching these movies. And this is sort of our red carpet segment. So, David, how is your hot dog dressed?
So I'm really excited about this one, John. So I want you to imagine this entire process I'm going to throw out there.
Okay,
so I want you to take a bun and place it in a bed of blue rice. I don't care how you make that rice. You could probably use some food coloring. Run a skewer through a piece of lettuce and jam that into the bun, and now you have a boat. Once you have all that ready, you set it aside. You boil some hot dogs in salt water. That's important because it's on the high seas here. You slice that up, and you put half it on the boat and half in the rice, and now you have a Mutiny on the Bounty. You can add the condiments however you want.
Just ketchup everywhere.
That's the blood.
Yeah, it's the blood. Okay, I think I'm going to have a chili lime mango salsa put on a hot dog. Lime for those limeys, sailors that we are going to discuss today in this podcast. And I'm going to throw up a link to the recipe that I found online for this chili lime mango salsa to put on the hot dogs.
So one of the things we also talk about is sort of hot dog adjacent foods, sort of the what people were eating at that time. And I did a little bit of research into what sailors in the English Empire at the time ate. So, John, what do you think sailors ate at this time?
Well, I'm going to go with limes because that's what I just said. Lots of limes. Probably some kind of rum and some kind of food that they could store for a long period of time if they were out of the ocean for several weeks. So I don't know what that would be. Some kind of meat, maybe some dried meat, dried foods of some kind.
Yeah, I mean, you're pretty close. And one of the things, what I was getting at is that a lot of people think that these sailors didn't eat very well. And I think the opposite's the truth. So they had a lot of really protein-heavy foods. So we're talking about salted meats, cheeses and butters, dried peas, oatmeal, and just a metric shit ton of beer. When I was doing my research, I read that, you know, they might be rationed a gallon of beer a day. So these are maybe quasi-drunk guys on a boat that's rocking back and forth. All right, John, I know that you did some research into the history of what was going on in 1935.
Right, so this movie was released in 1935, and that was during the Great Depression. So, you know, that was just a terrible time for the U.S. economy. People didn't have jobs. There were really problems finding jobs and things like that. So movies were escapism for people. They would go to the cinema to sort of forget about their troubles. As a college story, Dave and I used to do that a little bit as well. So in the summertime, when we lived in the dorms at Ohio State, the dorms we had did not have air conditioning. They were cinder block rooms, and it would get to like 110 in there, right? They had these tiny little windows. The sun would beat against the buildings all day. There were a bunch of dudes. They're like, me and my roommate were in a room that was probably like 8x10. So there were two of us, and it was just miserable. So Dave and I would go to one movie at the movie theater, which had air conditioning, and then sneak into like two or three more in one day, just because we wanted to beat the heat. Dave, do you have any more movie escapism stories?
Yeah. So I've done this plenty of times. Like I like to watch movies when I'm not feeling good, and I have some go-to movies that I really enjoy. Surprisingly, one of those is Wizard of the Oz. But I think my biggest escapism story was on my birthday a couple years back. I was living in San Francisco in the Tenderloin, which is a really bad area, and in a micro apartment. So like it was me and my ex-girlfriend living in this basically a studio apartment, which is probably half the size of what you think it is. And I, right. For my birthday,
same size as the dorms that we were in college.
Yeah, it was absolutely miserable, the two of us living there. And I remember on my birthday, I had all my friends were out of town. I was by myself, so I was like, I'm going to go to the movies. I'm going to have a great time, and I did. And that's
Was it a porno theater? I think the Tenderloin is known for porno theaters.
The porno theater was three apartments down from my building. But no, I didn't go in there.
So what movie did you see, Dave?
I saw Man of Steel.
Man of Steel. Did you regret going to that movie immediately after watching it?
Everyone hates that movie. I like it. I'm definitely one of the minority. I should say that with a grain of salt. You know, I wrote my thesis on Superman, so I have a soft spot for that character.
I like the movie too, actually. I thought the Superman action scenes were probably the better Superman action scenes that I've seen. You know, as opposed to like the Christopher Reeve kind of campiness of those original Superman movies. I really liked like the fast paced action, like what you would see if you had two basically invulnerable people just in an all-out brawl. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And I own it. And I watched it before I went and saw Batman and Superman, and watched it again before I went and saw, Suicide Squad.
That was a terrible movie.
Both of those are terrible movies.
Yes. So, moving along, other things happening in 1935. Franklin Roosevelt was president. I think in 1935, the Social Security Act was signed into law. Let's see what else happened. The Lindbergh baby was kidnapped, and that was a very large trial that the nation followed closely, very much like the O.J. Simpson trial of its day. Airplanes were banned from flying over the White House. Parker Brothers released Monopoly for the first time ever. Babe Ruth retired, and his last game was played for the Boston Braves. Erwin Schrödinger published his paper, Schrödinger's Cat. Dave, do you want to describe what the Schrödinger's Cat theory is?
I knew you were going to punt that to me, and I don't have a good explanation. I mean, it's a cat in a box, and if the cat is alive unless you open the box, you know what? I can't really describe it. Can you describe it?
So the idea is that there are two or more scenarios happening inside of that box, and you don't know what they are until you open them, and it could be any one of those situations. So you could open the box, the cat could be alive. You could open the box, the cat could be dead. It's basically, you know, like, what is the state of the cat prior to opening the box? And there's like an infinite amount of possibilities to some degree. And he was saying, like, you know, like, is it because you open the box that the cat is dead, or is it, you know, is the cat alive and you're saving it? I don't know. It goes on something like that.
I think that's pretty good. If you want to know more, just look it up on Wikipedia.
Yep. Google it. Porky Pig debuted. Nazis were on the rise in Germany. And 20th Century Pictures was renamed 20th Century Fox. And Falling Water, which is Frank Lloyd Wright's architectural masterpiece, was completed. And it was done outside of Pittsburgh. The Hoover Dam was completed. And then also in 1935, I'm going to say two kings were born. The king of rock and roll, Elvis. And then the 14th Dalai Lama, who isn't exactly the king of Tibet, but that is essentially his role.
And John, did you do any research into the Academy Awards themselves?
Yes. The 8th Academy Awards were celebrated in 1936 for movies released in 1935. So Mutiny on the Bounty was awarded Outstanding Production, which at the time is essentially the Best Picture category, and it went up against 11 other films. So in Mutiny on the Bounty, one of the actors is Charles Laughton. He plays Captain Bligh, who we'll talk about in a minute. He was actually in one of the other movies that was up against Mutiny on the Bounty. He was also in Les Miserables. The movie cost a little under $2 million to make. It was nominated for 6 different Academy Award categories, but 8 different awards. So in the Best Actor category, 3 of the actors from the movie were nominated to it. So that was Clark Gable, Charles Laughton, and Franchot Tone. But none of them actually won. The Best Actor Award went to someone else in a different movie called The Informer. Since there were 3 actors nominated for this one role, the Academy actually decided to create a new Oscar for Best Supporting Actor and Actress. So as a result of these 3 actors being nominated, we now have that Best Supporting Actor and Actress categories. Dave, do you want to talk a little bit more about the actors in this movie?
Yeah. So this is the height of what I like to think of Golden Hollywood, and I find it really fascinating. So Clark Gable is probably the biggest star in this movie, and at the time he was the, if not the biggest star, the second biggest star. He was probably eclipsed by Shirley Temple. John, I really love Shirley Temple. I can't really name a movie she's in, but I have very fond memories of her as from when I was little.
What's the movie where she sings Tomorrow? Annie.
Yeah, and yeah, maybe I don't know if she's in Oscar-winning movies, but hopefully she is, and we'll get to her eventually. So Captain Bly was played by Charles Laughton, and this was Charles Laughton's most recognizable role, and it was spoofed many, many times, including by the Looney Tunes, which John and I actually watched before this podcast.
Yeah, it's the Looney Tunes. No more to say about that.
I really don't like Bugs Bunny.
Even just watching it now, I didn't really think it was that funny either. No Oscars for that.
Yeah. Okay, so another Hollywood fact. So MGM remade this movie in 1962, and it starred Marlon Brando as Fletcher Christian and Trevor Howard as Captain Bly. This is sort of weird, but Brando ended up marrying Gable's co-star and love interest in the original movie. I'm going to butcher this name. It's Movida Castaneda. Some more interesting things. So in an effort to break the ice, Clark Gable took Charles Laughton to a brothel before the film began, and apparently Laughton thought that was very flattering.
Yes. So just to clarify that other point that you were making, Dave. So Fletcher Christian in the 1935 version is played by Clark Gable, and Movida is Clark Gable's love interest in the 1935 version. Marlon Brando played Fletcher Christian in the 1962 version and married Movida. So there's that weird connection there. Dave, I've never taken you to a brothel. Would you be flattered if I did that?
I mean, I if we were trying to break the ice, certainly. Maybe not on a Sunday night.
I feel like that's not the way I would break the ice with most people. I feel like when I meet someone, it's usually a client. I'm like, hey, you want to go to a brothel? Most of them are women. They've never agreed to this.
I hate icebreaker games. I know. I'm sure you've had to do them too. I absolutely hate those games. Like, they're so terrible.
What's the weirdest icebreaker question you've been asked?
I can't name the weirdest one because I try to tune them out. Like, I just don't want to participate in them. Do you have a really weird one?
Not off the top of my head, but I agree with you that like maybe we should just find a topic of interest that we can both share. Oh, someone threw one at me the other day. Like, what is your favorite album of all time, or something along those lines? Or it's like, what album do you listen to when you work out, or something like that? I didn't have anything prepared. Like, I don't know. Like, I just don't have that. Like, it's not something that comes naturally to me. Like, I'm like, yeah, every time I work out, I listen to this like one jam. It's like my go-to jam. I don't know. It was tough. It was a stumper, actually. I was like, I don't have an answer. Next question.
I can answer that question. I listen to Alkaline Trio. That's my workout jam.
Always just the same album.
It's number one on my iTunes, so I always put it on. It's also followed by Anamanaguchi, so kind of all over the place.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah.
So some more facts here that are pretty funny. So Gable tried to get out of playing Fletcher Christian. He objected to having to wear breeches and he felt that they were too feminine, and he didn't want to shave his signature stash. John, have you ever had to work somewhere where they made you wear like an outfit or like a breeches or something funny?
Maybe not breeches exactly, but in high school I did work at a movie theater and I had to wear a uniform there it was like a suit coat and tie, because apparently that's what people who are janitors should wear, because I was essentially a janitor. Yeah, so I probably agree with him that I shouldn't have to look ridiculous for no reason, but it is for a role, and he also got paid pretty handsomely, I'm sure, so he shouldn't be complaining too much.
Well, he did it. He ended up doing it.
I do say that I did not recognize Clark Gable without his mustache in here. I think his famous role is Gone with the Wind, and you can kind of recognize him, and that's kind of the image everyone sees of Clark Gable. Seeing him in this role without a mustache, again, I did not know it was him.
Yeah, it is night and day. I knew it was him because I had looked at the IMDb page prior, but yeah. And I haven't seen a lot of movies. Like, I've seen maybe a third of Gone with the Wind. And so this is really my first true exposure to him. And I liked it. I can see why people liked him as a star. So one more fact. So the producers of the movie thought by having the two main stars being sort of, how do I put this?
They're polar opposites.
They wanted the two main stars to be polar opposites, so that sort of animosity would appear on the screen, and that was one of the reasons that they went for Lawton. So Lawton is he's known as a bisexual, and Gable is I didn't know this is a well known homophobe. So they thought that the two would really sort of not like each other on the screen, and I think it came through. I do think that there was sort of a tension between the two.
I definitely think they played the roles really well. There was definitely some tension, and maybe some of that arose out of these other things. But it does seem like Gable went out of his way to flatter Lawton with his brothel proposition, even if he didn't know that he was Lawton kind of leaned gay.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and I guess, you know, this has been done in Hollywood and other places too. So I know during the filming of Saving Private Ryan, you know, that movie is about, you know, this platoon of guys trying to rescue Matt Damon, and who is Private Ryan, and all the other guys went through basic training together, and Matt Damon did not have to do that. And they thought that would sort of play up in the movie a little bit, because they were really unhappy that they had to go save this one person, and they thought that would come through if they did that.
So that's a movie that we're going to get to eventually, isn't it?
Did that win Best Picture? I don't think it did, actually. I think American Beauty came out that year too, and I think American Beauty won.
Oh, I'm sure I've seen that movie and I can't remember it at all.
So Dave, I know you also wanted to talk a little bit about the book that sort of influenced this movie.
Yeah. So overall, I mean, there's not a ton to say about this book that the movie is based on. So it was based off a novel that came out in 1932 by the same name, and it was by Charles Nordoff and James Norman Hall. And that book became the first in a trilogy called The Bounty Trilogy. My friend really likes it. I haven't read it, so I can't recommend it. The book was a fictional first-person account of real-life events. So Roger Byam, he was based off someone in the crew, but he didn't really exist in real life, and the book was written through his point of view. Some historians have really called into doubt the accuracy of Captain Bligh's treatment of the crew, but according to History.com, he did suffer three mutinies, so that says something about his character. The pro-Bligh group argue that Bounty's inexperienced crew were corrupted by the idyllic island, and the island did look pretty nice, John.
It is Tahiti. You know, to add on to some of those things, I watched a short documentary on the Mutiny on the Bounty story, and they said Captain Bligh was a pretty meticulous record keeper, and according to his records, he actually dished out punishment a lot less than other ships at the time. I think part of it also could have been that, you know, the inexperienced crew that you were saying, but a lot of those guys were conscripted into service. You know, they were forced into serving in the Navy, so I'm sure they didn't want to be there either.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to get to this maybe a little bit later, but press gangs were real. Those were real things, and I'm real happy that's not going on right now.
I know. Just imagine sitting in a bar one day, which is basically how this movie starts, and some soldiers kick in the door and say, you, you're going to be out at sea for the next 2 years getting beat by this Captain Bligh, and you're just like, oh, shit. Just my luck. Just wanted to get a drink, have a nice quiet evening, away from the home, and, you know, here I am getting conscripted into military service.
Yeah. So, John, I know that you also had some historical facts about the Bounty itself and the events that inspired the book and movie.
Right. So I think just one really note here is the Bounty was the smallest type of warship in the British fleet, and it was classified as a cutter. And as a result, that meant two things. One, there wasn't a detachment of Marines on the ship who would have normally kept the sailors in line, which basically prevented mutinies from happening. And the other one was that due to its size, it didn't actually get a full captain on the ship. So it got a more junior officer. It got a lieutenant, which Captain Bligh, although he was called Captain Bligh because he was in charge of the ship, wasn't actually a full captain at the time. So he didn't really have the rank that went with it. And both of those things probably helped exacerbate the situation. And then I guess one other fact I said two. I really meant three, I guess. Was that the bounty ship? Their journey was to go to Tahiti, collect these breadfruit plants that they were going to then transfer to the West Indies, which is the Caribbean, to plant. And the breadfruit produces fruit they wanted to feed their slaves very cheaply. And the breadfruit produces a large yield. So a third of the boat was actually converted into a greenhouse for these plants. So the sailors were really in cramped quarters. Captain Bly didn't get his own quarters either in this time. And the documentary I was watching said that it would have been more crowded than a World War II submarine. So the guys were just like packed in there. So, you've got conscripted guys who don't want to be there, an inexperienced captain, a small ship without Marines preventing sailors from misbehaving. It was basically just a powder keg waiting to happen, like just explode in the middle of the ocean.
If only they had a way to escape, John. If only they had movies or something like that.
Exactly. So, I mean, we've talked a little bit. That's sort of the background of the story there. So you sort of know how the movie starts. Opening scene, Dave, I know you love the scene. You want to tell us about it?
Yeah. So opening scene, it is essentially the credits with a sea shanty happening in the background. I really like sea shanties. I wouldn't think I would, but I'm going to create a Spotify account for it or Spotify list and try to pull out some really good sea shanties. Maybe I'll share it on the blog. So it really, there's not much to talk about there. John, do you like sea shanties?
Well, Dave, considering I don't have a go-to gym playlist, maybe I'm going to make a sea shanty gym playlist. but I don't really have any opinions, but I did kind of like the sea shanty opening. It really did set the tone, and it was nicely done.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, so after that, we move on to a scroll, and this is basically setting up what's going to happen in the movie. Think about it as sort of like the Star Wars scroll, and we find out that the HMS Bounty is off to get breadfruit from Tahiti, and they want to use that to feed slaves. John's already talked about this a little bit.
Yep.
Have you tried breadfruit, John?
I don't think I have. I can't remember what time that I have. I do actually do this thing where I go to grocery stores, and not so much in D.C., right? I have tiny little grocery stores. But when I'm back home in Ohio, we have gigantic grocery stores, and there's like weird fruit laying around. And I usually pick two or three things to take home, like bring back to the house with me that I've never heard of before. So it is possible that I've had breadfruit, but I don't know for sure. Have you had breadfruit, Dave?
No, not that I know of. It's like one of the things that maybe it's in something, but call it something else. It's supposed to taste like a potato or like a warm bread. I don't know why a potato and a warm bread are supposed to be similar. But
potato bread, Dave. Potato bread.
Maybe, but I didn't read potato bread. I read potato and then bread. So I'm thinking it's bland and starchy. That's like really what I think.
I'm gonna go try to find breadfruit. I will try to find it the next time I go to the grocery store and see if they have it there.
Well, you try to find breadfruit. I will continue my hunt for horse meat.
Okay.
Okay. So here we come. Next is the first scene where we're actually introduced to someone.
So the first person we meet, I guess the first thing we see is the conscription scene that we were talking about, right? So we're watching these sailors get pressed into service, and it's Fletcher Christian. So he is going to be the number two guy. He is pushing these sailors into service. I think my favorite part of that scene was when Fletcher is talking to these would-be sailors. He says to one of them, what about you? What do you do? And the guy's like, I'm a tailor. And then he grabs the guy, and you see that he's got a big Navy tattoo on his chest. And he's like, oh, is that your needlework? And I thought that was kind of like a funny little scene. But it also introduces, I would say, the comedic relief. So a lot of the sailors we see in this scene, I think, serve as comedic relief throughout the movie. They have funny little moments where they're doing something silly. Or just like not exactly disobeying the captain, but just, being dumb, ignorant fools on a boat, basically.
Yeah. And my favorite part about this scene is when you have one of the, I should back up and say that there are a lot of cast members that their names just elude me. There's a lot of people on the boat who you might know their face. But one of these people was drinking a beer, and he hands it to his wife, and his wife's eyes just, like, get giant. And she looks so happy to have this big, frothy beer. And I thought that was really funny. And to talk about your point about sort of the duality of tones in this movie, you're going to go from being very serious to being kind of absurd at several points of this whole film.
Yeah, and that was definitely – I mean – The mutiny itself is a very serious event, and the whole thing around it, which we'll discuss as we sort of go through our description here, it was, you know, really serious. And they definitely had, as we said, these more comedic moments to lighten the mood a lot, or it would be a very dark and heavy movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure we'll talk about that more in the, I think, opinion section. So once we're introduced to Fletcher Christian, we change scenes, and then we are introduced to Roger Byam. And he's a young, upper-crust Englishman, and he's joining the bounty to make a dictionary of the Tahitian language. So he's doing this at the behest of Joseph Banks, and Joseph Banks is a leading scientist of the day, and really what they're trying to do is to see if this whole mission can happen. Is it possible to feed slaves cheaply?
Yeah, well, Joseph Banks had a lot of slaves in the West Indies, so this was him, you know, not only commissioning this voyage to collect this breadfruit, but it was really for him to make more money. And I know that the Admiralty, which is basically the people in charge of the British Navy at the time, kind of viewed this mission as a grocery run. And I think sort of said to themselves that Captain Bligh took it way too seriously. You know, for like the level of effort and seriousness of the mission.
Yeah. So how would you describe Roger Byam?
Roger Byam, he is this plucky, I mean, at least in the movie here, he's this like plucky guy who, I guess he's, that I didn't quite gather this information, but he is part of the upper crust to some degree. I don't know if he's a royal or not. But he is going to be an officer and a gentleman on this boat, and he is a midshipman, which means he's being introduced to the Navy so he can gain more experience. This will probably be his first mission out on the ocean, and he seems very smart. When he's talking to Fletcher Christian, you can tell that Byam knows his stuff. You know, he knows his nautical terms. He knows how to do things on a ship. He knows how to navigate, and that's kind of what he's doing. So he seems like a smart, nice guy generally.
Yeah, he. This was probably my favorite scene with him. He felt like an up and comer. He was very much excited to be on the ship.
Yeah, and I mean, we're also introduced to Fletcher Christian in these two scenes of one, the press gang, and like this second scene of him meeting his co-star, essentially, or one of his co-stars. And you know, what did you think about Fletcher Christian? You know, how did they portray him in this movie?
He seemed kind of bemused constantly. Just like he's like, I'm doing this because I have to. I'm on this boat, but I know better than everyone. A little swarmy or swarvy, maybe, if that's the right word. He was fine. You know, he was sort of prototypical good guy.
Yeah. So, I mean, you see this a couple times early on. You know, they established in the press gang scene when they told those sailors that they were conscripting into the service that the captain was going to be Captain Bligh. All of the sailors panicked and really wanted to get out of that situation. And Fletcher Christian is, you know, the foil to Captain Bligh. He's always, like, Captain Bligh's doling out punishments constantly to the crew, and Fletcher Christian is there to prevent that from happening to some degree, or try to talk some sense into the captain, or letting the men know that, you know, like, he is trying to make sure that everything is fair. And then, so the next scene we see there is all the families from the Navy, or all the sailors, are on the boat, and they're all saying their goodbyes, and there are merchants on the ship that are trying to sell things to these sailors, and the Captain Bligh shows up, and then, I mean, you kind of know immediately that he does not fool around, you know, he's all about strict adherence to the rules. He's like, all right, you know, this is a ship, everyone off, you know, like, all the families have to leave now.
Yeah, let's describe how he looks like. He's sort of a short, a little bit pudgy, dour expression. When he walks around, he looks like he sort of stalks. So like, I can definitely see why Lawton was nominated. Throughout the whole movie, I really thought he was probably the best actor in the film.
I agree. I think he had a tough role too. He had the more serious role, and he played a villain essentially. So it was tough, and I think he did a really good job. And you really didn't like him, you know, in the movie. So he did his job well.
That's interesting, because I didn't like him, but at points I empathized with him.
I think historically that was kind of shown to be true. So Fletcher Christian, we can talk about him a little bit more, but you know, Fletcher Christian wasn't exactly this great guy either. According to historical accounts, he and Captain Black actually got along really well. Fletcher Christian was a broke royal. I guess his family had fallen on hard times, and while they were out at sea, Captain Bligh loaned him some money, I think while they were in a port somewhere, and then expected Fletcher Christian to pay it back and kept reminding him of it. And that was just really something that Fletcher Christian did not like, because he was a royal and he really felt, you know, just out of place. And, you know, it was kind of embarrassing for him, to him being a royal, having to basically beg for money. And that created a lot of tension between Captain Bligh and Fletcher Christian at a certain point, too.
Yeah. And so there's one character that I want to make sure we introduce in this scene, and that is Bacchus. Bacchus is a rotund, one-legged, drunken doctor who essentially he's not quite comic relief, but a little bit. They described him as the heart of the ship. I don't know if that's accurate, but he's definitely well liked among the ship, and he's pretty funny. I don't actually know who the actor is, but I laughed when they introduced him.
Historically, also, you know, the doctor was known for being a drunkard, and he actually died on the ship when they were out sailing, and he actually accidentally killed someone on the ship that he was trying to treat. Whatever the treatment was that he was doing, he ended up giving that sailor a blood infection, and then he tried to cover it up. So, those kind of things.
You are a font of knowledge about this.
It was like a 25-minute documentary. It told me all these things. It was great.
All right. So once Captain Bligh is on the ship, he immediately kicks everyone off. He's like, "Get off my ship! This is serious time." And he lines everyone up, and he brings a sailor onto not the ship, but onto a rowboat next to the ship, so everyone can watch the punishment being handed out to him. And what we find out is that this man who's tied up is already dead. And the man who's supposed to whip the dead man asks the captain, he's like, "Should we actually do this? This guy's already dead." And the captain says, "Yes." So it sort of sets the tone for the rest of the movie that this guy is... He's literally beating a dead horse. He doesn't care what's happening. He just wants his crew to see what he would do to them.
I think part of that was that also showing how strictly he had adhered to rules. So, you know, the crown, I think, as he said that man was supposed to get 400 lashes, and living or dead, he was going to get those 400 lashes.
Yep.
All right, so the next thing we see is Fletcher Christian on the boat with the midshipmen, who are the junior officers, and he's giving them a lesson on sailing. And we find out, we sort of come to realize that Fletcher Christian and Roger Byam, you know, they get along pretty well, and it's clear that they are going to be friends on this trip. So go ahead, Dave. You were about to say something?
Yeah, so what... He's giving him a lesson, and essentially two of the midshipmen, one of them gets jealous of Byam, essentially, because he answers a question correctly, and a fight breaks out, and that leads to the next scene.
So Captain Bligh sees them fighting and says, you know, this is no way to behave. They're in a very severe storm at the time, too. And Bligh goes to Bim, you know, "You got to go. You know, your punishment is going to be to go all the way up the mast to the very top, and you have to stay there until tomorrow." And so he does that, and then he ends up passing out up there. Fletcher Christian isn't around when that fight breaks out and sees that, you know, Bligh's tied up to the mast, goes up there and brings him down. Captain Bligh notices that Bim's not still up there and makes Bim go back up to the top. So, you know, Fletcher Christian has literally lowered him down because he's out in the elements in this terrible storm. He's lowered him down from this mast, and he then has to go back up.
John, what's the worst punishment that you've ever had?
Like corporal punishment? I don't really know, Dave. Punishments. I know my mom would ground all of us for like months at a time and mark it on her calendar. So she is, in a way, a Captain Bligh-like character.
Yeah, I was thinking about this question too, and I don't have, I mean, I can't think of one that's like really stands out. That's because, you know, if you only get punished when you're caught.
So what are you saying, Dave?
I'm just saying don't get caught.
All right. All right, and then we see shortly thereafter Captain Bligh still handing out punishments. Dave, you like this line? Like, what were Captain Bligh's insults to the crew?
Yeah, he called them a disgrace to saltwater, and I really, really love that line and the way he delivered it.
So the next thing we see is this montage of torture. Captain Bligh's like whipping everyone and like tying people to rails and just being a jerk, and the food is like cutting rations of people as punishment and things like that. We see someone keel hauled. Dave, do you want to describe what keel hauling is?
Yeah, so I didn't know what keelhauling was before I saw this movie, and then I looked it up on Wikipedia. It's essentially when you run a person underneath the boat from one end to the other. You can imagine how dangerous that is.
Yeah, so like on those ships, since they've been in the water so long, like barnacles are growing on there, and all these really sharp things have kind of clung to the boat, and they're dragging that sailor across, those really sharp things. So it's like a menace of punishment, and you're underwater at the same time. So we see in this case that the sailor dies from the keel hauling, and then we find out, as the next scene goes into Captain Bligh inventorying foodstuffs. And there's these sailors pulling things out and showing him what they have. Captain Bligh notices that there are 100 pounds of cheese that have gone missing, and he's going to punish the crew for this. But it actually turns out that the sailors, under Captain Bligh's orders, delivered the cheese to his house, that 100 pounds of cheese. And Captain Bligh remembers that he did, in fact, do that, but then basically is ready to punish everyone because, they basically tattled on him to some degree.
I think this is sort of a funny scene in the terms of, film in general, because it hinges on cheese. Like, when's the next time you're going to say a major event hinges on cheese?
I don't know. Something in Wisconsin, I'm sure, hinges on cheese.
Yeah, so the next scene after that, all the midship, not the midshipmen, but the senior officers, the people who are immediately below Bligh, they're having dinner in Bligh's quarters, and all the junior officers refuse to eat any cheese out of solidarity with the rest of the crew.
Because the rest of the crew has been punished and are on limited rations at this point.
Yes, exactly. And Bligh takes this as an insult, and he's like, "Well, fine, like you can get out. You can't eat with me. I'm gonna just eat all the cheese I want." And you start to see the really everyone solidify against Bligh. There are people who are on his side, but you're now starting to see people be very, very upset with this man. I thought this was a little strange, and we talked about this off podcast. I thought the order of keel hauling to cheese theft maybe should have been flipped, because I thought death was worse than being a hypocrite. And I think, John, you had some thoughts on that too.
Yeah, I had some thoughts on that as well. I kind of, in my mind, the keel hauling could have been done as a punishment. And I don't necessarily agree with corporal punishment, but I think the hypocrisy of the person doling out these really strict punishment is actually worse in my mind than him, giving out those punishments, because, he's upholding all these people to these high standards and then beating them when they don't follow suit. And to have that person also not being living up to those standards and not receiving a punishment, to me, is worse.
I think that's a really good point. Okay, so we move on, and the rest of the crew, because they're on half rations, and what the food they are getting isn't very good. You start seeing discontent, and there's fights breaking out over what they capture in the sea. So they capture the sort of the goofy group, the goofy crew. They capture a shark, and people start fighting over it. And you can see that tensions are really, really high. And this culminates with the captain going to Christian F or Fletcher Christian and asking him to sign the logbook, saying that all the crew received the appropriate amount of rations that they were marked to receive. And Fletcher Christian refuses because the captain hasn't been giving it to them. But eventually, under threat of court martial, Fletcher does sign the logbook, and he says, well, there's going to be a court of inquiry when we get back. And he basically is sort of throwing down the gauntlet, saying, like, I'm doing this under protest, but when this is all over, there's going to be a reckoning. And to which the captain replies, we're a long way from England, and anything can happen.
Yeah. So things are getting tense on the boat. And just after that, they arrive in Tahiti. Dave, I know you caught a few things in this scene that I did not catch. You were talking about the music of the scene when they arrived in Tahiti.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure, but I think it's the Popeye theme immediately when they see it. It's really quick. It's probably only 5 seconds, maybe less, but I think it's the Popeye theme.
I didn't notice that, but I think that's kind of like a funny little homage that they might have thrown in there. That's kind of cool. What happens next is that the crew disembarks, and some of the crew is sent on shore. So they're going to be there for 5 months, kind of just for shore leave. And some of the crew has to stay on the ship to get it ready to transport this breadfruit that they're going to take around the world. And the captain tells Fletcher Christian that he's going to be on the boat all those 5 months and is not allowed to leave.
Yeah. But then almost immediately after that, and in sort of a hard cut, we don't know how much time has passed, Fletcher Christian's on the island, and he goes and meets Byam, and we learn that for some unexplained reason, he's been given shore leave. And they sort of meet some young ladies, and they're gallivanting around, and one of the captain's runners comes running up to Fletcher and says, you know what, you have to come back to the ship. And what we deduce from that is that the captain is really screwing with Fletcher. He's giving him a little bit of taste of what the island's like, and he's trying to get Fletcher to commit some type of act in which he can be punished by. Instead of, you know, going back to the ship, though, Fletcher's like, he just disappears, and they go tell the captain that they can't find him. So he has, you know, I don't know how much time, but it seems like a couple of days worth of freedom on this island where he starts to fall in love with what John would have called the hedonism.
Yeah, so he meets this lovely island native who he starts to fall in love with. And then they have this romance scene, and it's 1935 romance, which means that Fletcher Christian puts his arm around her and sort of leans in, and then they cut away and show the moon, and then they cut back and they're still in the same position, and then they cut back again and it's the ocean.
And, waves, big waves.
Yeah, and then they cut back to this native lady's face, and she's like kind of enjoying herself. She's laying on the ground. And then there's these crazy dancers that they cut to. And that is sexy times in 1935 on the screen there.
Yeah, I think it was pretty hot, John.
I thought it was kind of funny. but it definitely, like, if you were a little kid and watching that, you wouldn't know what's going on, right? It's a way to infer business time without actually showing business time.
Yeah, yeah. What got me about the scene was the age difference between the two of them. So the actress was 19 or 20, and Clark Gable was around 34 at the time. So I thought that was a little bit strange. When I first saw it, I thought she was actually younger than 19, so I was glad to find that out.
Let's see. So then, I guess we sort of see the crew's on the island for 5 months, and some of them form relationships with the women on the island. Some of them get married, things like that. And then on the way out, we see that Tahini, so that's the native that Fletcher Christian, or Christian Fletcher, falls in love with, gives Fletcher these giant pearls. And Fletcher's like, I can't take these, you know, these are priceless. And through Byam, who's translating, Tahini says it's for his mother, for Fletcher Christian's mother. And he's, you know, he thanks her, and then they get back on the ship. All the men start boarding the ship again because they're ready to take off. And Captain Bligh starts confiscating all the things that they acquired on the island, saying that, you know, they're on the king's time and the things that they've gotten are really the king's.
Yeah, he's a real dick at this point.
Yeah, and then Fletcher gives over the pearls and says to Bligh that, you know, you remember that these are for the king. Sort of saying, you know, I know what's up. We remember the cheese incident.
I still love that it's cheese.
Yeah. We could call it the string cheese incident because it doesn't really define what kind of cheese it is.
It was a wheel. It was like, I bet it was some type of wheel.
Okay, so then what happens, Dave?
Yeah, so as they're preparing to leave, they find out that a couple of people who hadn't had shore leave had snuck off the boat and went missing, and they were brought back, and basically were going to be punished as deserters, and these guys were like, no, we're not deserters, we're going to come back, we just wanted to see the island, because we haven't seen it before. And the captain lines everyone up as he's wont to do and gets everyone ready to see him whip these deserters, or quote-unquote deserters. And we find out that Bacchus, the doctor, he's really sick and he can't make it up the stairs to see this action happen. And there's some back and forth. And eventually, Bacchus makes his way up there under sort of forced to do it. And as the whipping happens, he falls over dead. And what you can see from this is that the captain has caused a beloved member of the crew to die by overworking him, essentially.
Yeah. And things only get worse from there. So they take off. It turns out the breadfruit needs more water than they initially thought. So rations are cut for the men.
This is like, what is this? Like 1/16th of what they should have?
I don't know, but it's much, much less. And, you know, so they start grumbling, and Fletcher Christian's originally like, you know what, guys, it sucks. We have to follow the captain. You know, it's the captain's in charge. The beatings continue. The morale does not improve because the beatings continue. And finally, Fletcher Christian, you know, kind of snaps, and he takes over the boat. So he and some other sailors grab all the guns in the munitions room, and then take all the Blythe loyalists captive.
So they take them all captive, and they put as many as can fit onto a small boat and push them out to sea. One of the people who's not on the boat is Roger Byam. He was a loyalist to the captain, but he didn't fit on the boat, and I think he, being friends with Fletcher Christian, saved him. And really the implication is that these men are going to die at sea. They just, Fletcher put them out there to die, and you're going to either drown or die of thirst or hunger.
Right. So they couldn't fit all the people on the boat, and so some of them stayed on the mutiny, or on the Bounty. And I was reading historically about this as well, and Fletcher Christian actually kept some of the people on the boat that were considered essential personnel. So I don't remember exactly who they were, but it was like the navigator and some other people. He did not let them go onto that boat, but they couldn't really fit any more people on that boat. It was 20 people. And historically, the mutiny was really a little bit less than half the crew. So there were a lot of people that wanted to go on the boat with Bligh. And this is actually, I think, the most interesting part of the story. So Bligh gets set adrift in the ocean, and he essentially navigates that little boat with one little sail about 3,000 miles or something crazy like that to the nearest Dutch colony. And they survive. It's, you know, it's like 20 days plus at sea.
Yeah, I think it's more like 40 to 50. And I agree with you. Like, this is it's done very well in the movie. You can see that he's an expert navigator. I'm really interested in knowing more about the historical context, because this guy had to, he'd really be a badass to get this to happen.
He was a badass. So historically, he was on Captain Cook's voyage, and Captain Cook circumnavigated the globe, and Bligh was the navigator there. So he knew his stuff, and you know, he went on to sail much more, and you know, was kind of all over. He basically did the same journey later, circumnavigated the globe. So he definitely knew how to get around the ocean, and that's, he used his expertise to get them back. Probably that, and his just being a mean old bastard, you know, just like saying like, I am going to get back just to see you put in jail.
Yeah, so we cut to about 2 years in the future. We're back on the island. It's Christmas time. All the mutineers have gone back. They have married. They've acclimated. Fletcher Christian has a child. And they're just really jovial, essentially. And then out in the distance, they see a ship. And we find out that's a British ship. And all the men freak out because if they're captured and brought back to England, they're most likely going to die. They're going to be hanged or something along those things. So Fletcher Christian takes all the loyal men that weren't mutineers, get on the Bounty, and they head off. And this leaves Roger Byam and some other few loyalists on the island, and they've been living there and having a great time too. And they decide, well, we're not mutineers. We're going to go meet this ship and help guide them into Tahiti. And once they get to the ship, though, Bligh is there. And we find out that Bly thinks they are mutineers. He said, you didn't put up enough of a fight, so you are going to get locked up in this tiny, tiny hold in the middle of our ship, and if we get back to England, you're going to have a trial.
Right. So I guess just to cover that story a little bit more, you know, the story is that when Bly is set adrift, Bynum was actually below deck and was held there, so he didn't know that, he tried to escape, essentially, and he sided with Bly, but Bly doesn't believe that happened. So he accuses him of being, Bly knows that Bynum's friends with Fletcher Christian, and he assumes that he has sided with him. So all these loyalists were then locked up and are taken back to England. But in that journey, Bly's trying to find Fletcher Christian still, and they actually run adrift and hit some reefs, and the big boat that they're on sinks.
So, yeah, and this is when we move into what I'm calling the law and order segment. So all these mutineers, these loyalist / mutineers, they end up back in England, and there's this big trial to figure out what actually happened on the ship, and Roger Bynum is the number one person that they are trying to try. It's sort of like watching the second half of a Law and Order episode. I'm not making this up.
Right.
It's where people are arguing back and forth, just like any typical courtroom drama you've seen. And John, do you have anything to add to that?
So just before that, just as a note on historical accuracy, you know, in the movie they show Captain Bly coming back to Tahiti to try to find Fletcher Christian. In reality, that didn't happen. So Bly stayed in England, and another captain went out to find him, and that captain ran adrift and hit these reefs and sunk the boat. And a bunch of the people that he had captured, some of them being loyalists, died. They drowned when that boat sank.
Yeah. So to jump back into the future, there's a lot of arguing about whether Roger Bynum is guilty. And he is. He's brought before the court. And right before that, we learn that if a dagger is facing towards him on this table when he walks in the room, it finds that he's guilty. And if it's turned sideways, he's not guilty. So he walks in, and lo and behold, he's found guilty, and this means that he is going to be hanged. And he gives a really, really strong and passionate speech saying, you know, I am loyal, but I'm still friends with this guy, and what Bly did is wrong.
Right, yeah. So he says, you know, Fletcher, Christian, and I are friends, but Bly was a terrible captain, and this is why this happened. He's like, I was loyal to him, but I'm not going to say that Fletcher Christian is not my friend.
Yes.
So he's found guilty, but Sir Joseph Banks kind of intercedes, and he's spared being hung, and he actually goes back. You see him going back to serve as a sailor or another midshipman on another voyage.
Yeah. And so meanwhile, we jump back to Fletcher Christian, and they have found an island, and they're going to live here for the rest of their lives. And what they decide to do is wreck their boat into the island. So one, to get rid of it so no one can see it, but also it forces him to stay there. So John, you did some research into Fletcher Christian, and especially the end of his life. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, so Fletcher Christian probably wasn't as a sympathetic character as one might think. In the movie, it's very much people are on his side. He's the nice guy. In the story, Captain Bly is kind of this jerk. In real life, Fletcher Christian, you know, was on this island. He married one of these Tahitian women, and he had three kids, and, you know, the natives and the crew, the remaining crew, fought a lot, and all of them were almost all of them were murdered by the islanders, because they tried to do terrible things. They were raping women, taking property, things like that. And Fletcher Christian died in an altercation with three natives. They just basically showed up at his house and murdered him one day. So he had a violent end, and that it kind of suggests that Fletcher Christian maybe wasn't such a great guy either, because maybe it was part of the situation that he was in as well, because all those different mutineers on that island, some of them were conscripted in, some of them were known criminals. You know, they just couldn't get along while they were there either.
Yeah. Once I read all that stuff, the historical Fletcher Christian was really sort of demoted in my mind.
Yeah, and then historically, when Captain Bly returned to England, he was hailed as a hero who had, you know, sort of survived this mutiny and also navigated this great distance across the ocean with basically nothing.
So let's move on to our opinions. So winner or wiener, John?
I think it's a winner. I do think there are some slow parts of the movie. I think the island, when they get to the island, things really slow down. It could be a pacing thing done intentionally to show that the island lifestyle is a bit more relaxed than how it is in the fast-paced ocean where they're constantly doing something and getting beat. But generally, I thought the acting was pretty good. I thought the story is interesting. I think historically, the story is actually really interesting. I think the love story, as I think you mentioned this earlier, is a little tacked on, doesn't really feel necessary, but that did happen. I don't know. What did you think, Dave?
I liked it. I liked it a lot. And I think my biggest gripe about it was that it felt sort of like two movies. So one of the things we didn't talk a ton about was sort of the absurd behavior of the secondary characters, these like men who are just sort of wandering around the ship saying weird things and doing funny things and making sort of big eyes at the camera when something funny happens. I felt like at times the movie couldn't decide if it wanted to be serious or if it wanted to be sort of a comedy. And I guess I would have liked him to cut back a little bit more on the absurd stuff and be a little bit more serious on the plight of the sailors. And I think that would make it probably a better film.
Yeah, I don't know. Did you have a favorite part of the movie?
Yeah, so this is such a small scene. It's probably only 2 or 3 seconds. I really liked the keel hauling thing. Now, I don't like keel hauling people, but the way they filmed it was that they drug a tiny figurine across the bottom of probably an aquarium, and I thought it was really, really well done for that time period. Just very quick scene. I also loved the language and insults in this movie. There was a lot of colorful and interesting language, and some of my favorite insults are "You're smart as paint," when he was yelling at one of the midshipmen. "Get up there, you crawling caterpillar," when someone was climbing up the mast. And this is a little bit paraphrased, and it's, "Your hammock looks like a Frenchman's knapsack." I don't even know what that last one means, but I like it.
I mean, Dave, I think that reminds me of the time when someone shouted about your knapsack. Do you want to tell people about that?
Yeah. I was walking to class, and someone drove down the street and yelled at me, "Nice knapsack, pansy." Which seems like the most Midwestern thing insult to yell at someone out of a car.
To be fair, you had a leather knapsack.
It's a satchel. It's not a knapsack.
Dave had a leather satchel, a red leather satchel with a cross stitched into it, which makes sense.
Yes, it makes sense because my last name is Cross.
So let's. Was there anything you didn't like about the movie?
I think I already touched on it. It was the juxtaposition of the absurd and the serious. I think the absurd parts were done well, but they were difficult when they put them together.
In a way, my thoughts parallel that. The movie could have been a little faster. I think there were lots of scenes that moved a little slow for my taste. So as we talked about earlier, the three leading men were nominated for Best Actor. Which one do you think did the best?
I think it's Lawton for sure. He had to have had the hardest role. He was more interesting to watch on the screen. I know that I don't know a lot about Clark Gable, but he felt like I've seen that type of role many, many times before. The white hat who always does the good thing, and he's kind of smirking, and he knows something else. I really just think Lawton knocked it out of the park.
I agree. I think Lawton's role as Captain Bligh was really well done. You really despised him throughout the movie. I thought he did it very well.
I was actually surprised that the third man, Frank Out, I forget his last name, but why he was nominated.
For Bligh, I don't know. I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, he said he was fine. Don't get me wrong. Like, I don't think he did a bad job at all. But compared to Gable and Lawton, he just wasn't in the same league.
Yeah. Okay, so Mary Fuck Kill, Bynum, Bligh, and Christian.
Okay, so easy kill, Bynum.
Okay.
Or sorry, excuse me. Kill Bligh, the captain, because you don't know what that guy's going to do to you.
Right.
Kill the captain. I guess you would fuck Clark Gable and then marry Roger Bynum.
I agree. I think in the movie, Bynum is kind of this nice guy who seems like a stable character. So I agree with your assessment there, Dave.
Yeah, I'm glad we're on the same page. That's why we're friends.
Okay, so next movie. We have three award wieners on the ballot. We have Shakespeare in Love, which actually I looked this up while we were chatting. That's the movie that beat out Saving Private Ryan for Best Picture that year. And that's about a young Shakespeare who's out of ideas and meets his muse, who inspires him to write one of his most famous plays.
We have Annie Hall, so that's a Woody Allen movie about a neurotic New Yorker, surprise, who falls in love with a ditzy Annie Hall.
And then we have My Fair Lady, which is a snobbish phonetics professor agrees to take a street urchin off the streets of England and make her presentable to high society.
Is that one a musical?
I believe it is.
It's exciting.
Okay, so fan mail. Dave, we had people ask us about animal Oscars.
And yes, animal Oscars.
And someone said, what the hell happened to Air Bud? Why didn't that dog make the list? Dave, what's your take on that?
Because he's a bad actor. The dog's a bad actor. I said it. I'm sorry. I know that there's a big love for Air Bud. There's probably like 11 Air Bud movies, but Air Bud's not a good actor. But you know who is a good actor? Babe the Pig. My number one animal Oscar.
Yep. I agree, Dave. No Air Bud for me either. Let's see. So if you want to send us fan mail, you can send things to david@awardwieners.com. You know, send your love to Dave. And if you have hate mail, you can send it to me. That's john@awardwieners.com.
And yeah, I only want your positive vibes. And don't bring me down.
Well, you can tell us we suck, but I want to know, like, it has to be constructive. You can tell us we suck, but then you have to tell us how we can do it better. So none of this just whiny bitchiness. You have to tell me how to fix it too. All right. So, also we like to feel validated. So leave a review on iTunes. That would be very nice for us, or, you know, send us money. That's cool too. Okay. So Dave, I guess we'll sign off and we'll see people next week.
Yeah. So you're always a wiener.
Yep. And we have something cooking for you, and we will let you know what it is soon.